You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Fosma Moon, and Seth Miller.
So a little bit of a fun episode we've got going on this week. David Feldman from Catch It Loyalty is here, and David's an old friend of mine. This is Seth, for those of you who haven't figured that out. Old friend of mine, and we're at a conference in Bangkok called Loyalty 2018, which, as you might imagine, is about loyalty programs, and it's travel loyalty for the most part. And it's interesting because he and I are, I'd say, probably the only two in the crowd that are definitely not 100% loyalty program or vendor related. We're a little bit also of the junkies. Not really looking for a cure, I don't think, but it's been an interesting conference just because we are sort of somewhere in the middle of seeing how the programs are all thinking and whatnot, and also representing consumers to them in some ways. Is that a fair assessment? I know you also work in the industry some as well, so I don't want to undersell that. But
I think that's fair, you know, Seth. I think that it's interesting. I mean, this quite often comes up in conversation, you know, around these conferences, is that a lot of the people working in the programs, you know, they try very hard. They struggle sometimes to really understand what the experience is like for their members. So whether if they're an airline, what's the experience like for their frequent flyers? If they're a hotel, what's the experience like for the people that are genuinely staying in their hotel? Why are they choosing their hotel over a different hotel brand? You know, in our case, we can help answer those questions. We are actually frequent flyers. We are frequent stayers. You know, we have experiences with these programs on the customer end.
Yeah.
But we also, you know, work with the programs on the program end in terms of their program strategy. We understand, you know, the financial implications. So it's interesting sitting in the middle of those two positions, because generally speaking, people are either the marketing folk inside loyalty programs, or they're the frequent flyer junkies, and that's great, but we just want to maximize our value that we get when we fly. How many points can we get? That kind of thing.
Not paying as much attention to the business side of it, and as well you shouldn't. Like that, if that's not, you know, it isn't your business. Your business is to get what you want for whatever you're willing to pay. So
I think it's also the point of, if you just purely from the consumer side, you know, the programs, you know, advertise, you know, rewards for if you fly us, we'll give you X, Y, and Z. And so therefore, you're either incentivized by those, that reward offering, so you fly them, or you're not incentivized by them and you fly somebody else.
Slight digression. You said X, Y, and Z. Have you lost Z, or is that not an Australian thing?
I think I've been hanging around you long enough that I almost never say Z anymore.
I actually recall from my presentation yesterday, I said Z once and Z once, and I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do at this point.
I think I get called out by my Australian colleagues all the time when I'm back in Australia for speaking American too much.
Yeah. Well, practice your Z. Let's get that back up there. Try to help you out on that. One of the interesting things I think we talked about a decent amount at the show here has been revenue-based.
Yes.
We had Air France KLM Flying Blue spoke a little bit about that. Southwest spoke a little bit about that. Any surprises, anything interesting there, or is this just the way it's going to be and we should all be ready for that?
Look, I think it's interesting. I mean, just in the morning tea break earlier, Seth, you know, there was, I won't name them, but another airline came up to us just to ask some views on that.
And I've had a couple of those conversations on these sidebars.
Exactly. Look, I think at a previous conference back in Palm Springs at the end of November, actually, I was on a panel with S7 Airlines, and one of the comments that they made, which I think was really relevant, is that it's important for other airlines in the industry, and other hotel groups for that matter, to not just blindly copy other programs just for the sake of copying them.
Sure.
And, obviously for our people that are in the US that are used to the changes, the revenue-based changes that have happened with Delta, American, United, when you talk about changes to revenue-based programs, it means something.
And also Southwest and JetBlue and previously Virgin America.
So absolutely.
Spirit, I think, is dollar-based also, isn't
it? Where you accrue your miles based on what you spend. Absolutely.
Whereas Alaska's the only holdout at this point.
That's right. You're still earning based on your miles flown. But when you talk about, you know, being in Asia or in Australia or in Europe, for example, I think the revenue-based term or the idea of switching to revenue-based program means something else. So, for example, there are programs out there where, technically speaking, you still earn your award miles based on how far you fly. But the reality is if you buy a more expensive fare, you know, you are earning so many more miles. So to some degree, you could say that maybe they are revenue-based. It's just, it's still kind of calculated by distance.
Right. So, I mean, right, and that's been a long-standing position. I think I was on a panel, I don't want to say one of these in New Jersey, one of the Freddie conferences, not this past Jersey one, but was there a Jersey before that maybe? I don't know. I sat on a panel discussion at some point.
They all blend into one.
And this was years ago, and the question was, when is Europe going to go revenue-based? And my answer was, we're already there.
I think that's fair, yes.
It's not quite as explicit necessarily, where it's your, you know, we care how many dollars you spend, or euros you spend, which is the new shift is they're saying, okay, it's this many dollars, do the multiplication, you're done. And it's also, you know, the argument is that simplifies things. And in some ways it does, but in some ways it doesn't, right? I mean, it's still, you have to go look something up from your ticket and then find a conversion table and then do the math and then you get some output comes from that.
I think if you're a regular flyer versus if you're a one-off, you know, once-a-year flyer, I think what the idea of simplicity or, you know, just an easy-to-understand program offering, that's going to be different for those two different types of people. The other thing is as well, if you're an airline such as a JetBlue, for example, is a great example, where you are primarily flying, you know, short transcon, domestic flights, if you're a Southwest, for example, and you are flying purely domestically, you know, it's a much different proposition to if you're flying over the ocean, you know, trans-Pacific, transatlantic.
Well, is it? I mean, right, is the argument there that you have to scale the rewards?
I think that's right. I think, look, a good example that comes to my mind is Virgin Australia. Virgin Australia, obviously very like Virgin, much like Virgin America was in the US. If you fly domestically in Australia, you earn miles based on how much you spend on your ticket. If you have elite status, you earn a few more miles per dollar spent. But for long-haul internationals, such as, you know, Sydney to Los Angeles, for example, on those type of length flights, you'll actually earn based on distance. Because if you just earn on the ticket cost, you're sitting in an economy seat perhaps for 14 hours, but you're not earning very many miles. So they've realized that for those super long distances, it doesn't quite work. Now, you could do things a different way. You could just simply have a minimum mileage guarantee on those kind of segments.
Sure.
And I think I think the important thing here is that when you fly and you buy a ticket, you're being loyal to the airline. It doesn't really matter how you earn, just as long as the amount you earn is meaningful.
And so I guess that's really what it comes down to is, are you earning enough points to feel like this was motivating? Did it skew my decision process?
I think that's exactly what it comes down to.
And obviously, all these companies are trying to skew those decision processes that we make every day when we go and book our tickets.
And I think the other thing that they're trying to do as well, which I think no one really has a complete objection to, is the idea that if you buy a more expensive fare or you're flying in first class versus in discount economy, that you are rewarded more.
Sure.
You know, I don't think that anybody has a big objection to that idea.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges has always been, how big should that spread be?
Yes.
And we're finding, we're finding that the spread is getting larger, but again, it goes back to depends on where. In Europe, the spread has always been very large, right? Going back a decade even, when the European airlines started cutting earnings at the low end of their earn rate, it was 10% for your cheapest coach fare and 300% for your...
And I think that's an interesting point because, you know, in America, the discussion has really just been, we're just going to award more miles for the people who buy more expensive fares. But as you say, in Europe and even in Asia, for example, you know, quite often on the cheapest fares, you've earned, you know, in fact, in some cases, you know, on Asian airlines, you've earned 0 miles
The
absolutely cheapest fares.
Europe too.
And whether that's right or wrong is a different decision. But yes, the difference between how much you'd earn on the cheapest versus the most expensive cabin fares was a lot larger than it traditionally was in the US.
Yeah, and I mean, it's hard to do the exact math because you have to figure out what the fares might have been. But is it a 30x spread from my no status $600 ticket from New York to Beijing and back versus what a top tier elite flying in paid business or paid first class is going to earn? Is that a, you know, $10,000 ticket? Maybe it's sort of the same thing. Has this been a whole lot of rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic? Have we moved a whole bunch of things around and changed all these programs and really sort of ended up right back where, or homogenized? I won't say where we started because everybody is sort of adjusting little bits here and there, but did we really just sort of all end up in the same place?
I think for our American listeners, Seth, it's, everyone's a little bit tainted by the fact that because the big three US airlines tend to literally mimic each other in a mirror image, you know, that kind of stains your thinking in terms of, okay, well, Delta, United, and American are always going to be basically carbon copies of each other. And it doesn't need to be that way. And around the rest of the world, it's not necessarily that way. But I think it comes down to your first question of, is everyone going to move in this direction? It's always a topic at these conferences.
Sure.
The discussion topic isn't going away. So yes, the reality is I think every airline that hasn't moved in that direction is at least going to have that conversation, and they're going to ask themselves two things. Are we sufficiently awarding our people who buy our more expensive fares sufficiently more than the ones that buy the discount economy fares? As you say, is it a 30x? Is it a 10x? And then the second thing being, you know, are we still awarding all of our flyers something meaningful enough that they're interested in the program? And I think the third thing is, and again, you raised this at the beginning, is it simple? Is it simple and easy for people to understand? And, you know, one of the things that some of the airlines are doing, and some have done it for a long time, some are, it's brand new, but what they're doing to make things simple is having that earning calculator, you know, on the front of the website, really easy that people can put in, okay, you know what, I'm flying from Paris to New York in, you know, discount economy, whatever it might be, how many miles am I going to earn? For a lot of people, it's actually really simple. If we remember back when Delta changed their program, they had that big calculator on the front that showed you how many miles you used to earn, how many miles you'd earn under the new one. Now, of course, most people got some pretty bad results and didn't like that.
There's some marketing challenges with necessarily publishing all that information so easily.
But, you know, maybe they didn't need to show the compare before and after because a lot of people didn't like the difference.
Well,
but at least making the new system easy to understand, people would be like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to earn 500 miles. Okay, fair enough.
So I agree that, you know, listen, I can do math. Right, I know how, and part of it is, but excluding taxes and fees and some of those things like that, I feel like if that was really the issue, you should have said 4x instead of 5x and just included everything.
And that's
right. You actually would have cost you less as a company to do that, and it would have been easier for your passengers. So, and you would have actually won.
And to use the Virgin Australia example for a second, again, they literally will award you miles based on how many dollars you spend on your fare. So it's exactly the same system, but they don't have this exclusion of taxes and fees. It's just if your ticket is $100.
That's actually good to know. That's the only one I can think of that doesn't.
If your ticket is $100, you'll get awarded your miles based on $100. And as you say, if that meant it was too generous because of the taxes and fees, then make it 4 times. But just make it simple for people to understand. And when we think about the US airlines, it's not just how many miles you earn, but they also put the minimum spend requirements on the status.
Yeah.
So for, you know, to use American Airlines as an example with Executive Platinum, it's 12,000 qualifying dollars you need to spend in addition to flying the right number of qualifying miles. But the problem is because of the exclusion of taxes and charges, if you spend $12,000 in American Airlines, that doesn't get you to over the line.
Right.
You need to spend $12,000 plus taxes and charges.
And I think that's because, as we talked about, the sort of lemming behavior, once Delta said, this is what it's going to be, the others, you know, you couldn't have Americans say, oh, we're also going to be, at the time it was $10,000, we're also going to be $10,000, but we're actually going to include taxes and fees. I mean, I guess they could have. Are you going to make it 15% easier?
What's interesting here is it results in two types of passengers. You have your super engaged passengers, you know, your super frequent flyers, you know, the people that really, you know, engage with understanding the programs, that then keep these complicated Excel spreadsheets,
right,
you know, that track every flight that they're planning, that they're traveled.
Who would possibly ever do such a thing like that?
I don't know anyone that would do that, absolutely. But on the other side, you have your, you know, not just once a year flyers, but I would still say regular frequent flyers, but they're not quite that level of geek, if you want to call it that. And they don't track it so closely, but that also means maybe they miscalculate. They don't quite get over the line.
I did this year.
And they just fall short, and then it's a bad passenger experience, and it's a bad member experience.
I came up 195 miles short of Delta Gold this year. I will say they gave it to me.
Good effort on their part.
My MQDs were very high because it was a couple of business trips, paid business class, other people's money. I had a couple trips to Europe. I think it was the smart move, A, both because I won, and B, because my numbers looked really good to them.
Sure.
But
that's the right thing, but it would also just be simpler, you know, if the earning system wasn't quite as complicated, and you wouldn't have to worry about, oh, did I get over the line? Did I not get over the line? Do I need to have a spreadsheet to make sure I get over the line?
And so when we keep talking about making it more simple, like, is any of this more simple? And I guess, but again, you have to have thresholds, you have to have tiers. Have to is a relative term, but like there's reasons to do all of those things. So that makes sense.
And I think when we talk about the US carriers, I mean, we have to accept and admit one thing, and that is that the old systems weren't simple either. They were very complicated. And
I'm just not convinced the new ones are more simple.
I agree on that. And
maybe a little bit, but not enough to justify massive upheaval and pissing so many people off.
I think that is the lesson for any of the other airlines around the world that we see at these conferences that are looking at this is, you know what? You can change your system. It really doesn't matter how you decide to award your miles to your customers, but if your goal is to keep things simple, do a sanity check on your proposed program and even your existing program and ask, is it simple to your brand new member? Or is it only simple to your frequent flyer junkies?
Yeah.
You know, is it only understandable to your frequent flyer junkies?
Yeah. And so one of the interesting other things you mentioned just a few bit ago was the PQDs, EQDs, MQDs, the sort of dollar spend and whatnot. And the simplicity, and we've had, again, we talked about JetBlue a little earlier, we had Southwest up on stage earlier. The way that they approach their programs is massively different from most everybody, not everybody else, but all the legacy network carriers based on partners.
Yes.
And this shift creates huge problems from partners. One of the challenges there is, generally speaking, partners don't want to tell airlines how much people are spending. Like, they don't tell their partners, they don't want to tell how much their customers are spending. So I buy a ticket on Hawaiian Airlines, Hawaiian doesn't want to tell JetBlue how much that ticket cost.
Yes. And that's an issue. So even
there's fare buckets, but not specific costs.
The issue with these new systems, and again, to use the U.S. legacy airlines as an example, and I mean, I'll stick with
it. It's going to be a problem for KLM. It's going to be, or Flying Blue, it's going to be a problem for Miles and More.
And I'll keep with using American Airlines as an example because I started with that. And that is that's great. When I buy an American Airlines ticket, I'm earning my miles based on how much I spend. But if I fly on a partner airline on Finnair or Qantas or Cathay Pacific, now I'm earning based on fare class and distance. If I buy a vacation package, I'm earning based on fare class and distance. If I buy a fare from a online travel agent that happens to be a wholesale fare or something like that, it's based on...
And that's the hardest one because you don't know until you've purchased it.
And that's exactly right. So, you know, the reality is for your engaged flyers, it's actually more complicated now than it used to be under the old system. Now, does the average flyer pay attention to perhaps that? Probably not. They really just, they look afterwards. They see, oh, I earned some miles for my flight. And as long as it's the number seems to make sense for what they think that flight should have earned, roughly speaking, it's not a question. But, I mean, I had a flight, interestingly, Seth, last year. It was a Sydney to Los Angeles flight on United. And I think I earned a 100, even with my 1K bonus, I think I earned 137 United miles for a 7,500-mile, 12-hour flight.
137 PQDs or miles?
137 miles, award miles.
Well, that seems wrong, but how much did you pay for the ticket?
In fairness, it was a cheap ticket, but the reality was it was a multi-segment ticket.
Sure, and so they allocated.
And it just happened to be the way that they allocated the Trans-Pacific sector was they only allocated a very tiny amount of the fare to the Trans-Pacific sector. But looking at that mileage earning, you know, it looks at that, you look at that and you're like, wait, I spent 12 and a half hours or whatever it was in economy and you gave me 137 miles for that. I'm not really motivated by the program to stay with that.
Even putting an extra zero on it was 1,000 miles, which I've done those. I mean, that's a...
Yes.
I'm not a 1K, so I get my gold 8X multiplier per million miler. But, like, it's not hard to get a cheap enough ticket where you're only earning a couple thousand points to go to China and back.
Sure. Sure.
And that's competition and fares. And maybe they shouldn't be giving me points because I'm buying such cheap tickets and not really helping the bottom line as much as they want me to. But there... And I'm buying it because I don't care. I got to go and whatever. But there is...
You actually have to be there for a purpose.
Yeah, ish. but there is an argument to be made. At that point, are you defeating your loyalty program?
The interesting thing here is
from a sort of psychology perspective.
Yeah. Look, the interesting thing is are you motivating people or are you reinforcing the behavior that they chose you over flying competitors? So if I'm a United person, you know, obviously United, no matter how cheap the ticket is, because if the ticket's cheap, it's because of competition in the market and they can't sell the ticket at a higher price. If they could sell the ticket at a higher price, they would. Absolutely would.
Of course.
So the reality is if they're pretty good at revenue management nowadays, you know, there's always mistakes,
but
they're pretty good. So generally speaking, if the ticket is only a couple hundred dollars, it's because at least at that point in time, they don't expect that they're going to sell out the whole plane.
Right.
Now,
And usually there's someone else also selling that same $600 ticket to China.
That's exactly right. Now, the reality is they want me to fly, you know, if you're United in this case, rather than choosing American or, you know, Cathay Pacific or Hainan or, you know, China Southern or something like that. So the reality is you want to reinforce that behavior and you want the person to think afterwards, you know what, I made the right choice choosing United. I should keep flying United. But it's not just about flying. It's also a matter of you want them engaged in the program and you want them to feel that the mileage currency is meaningful to them because it's very profitable if you can get that person to take up the credit card. And it's very profitable if you can get them to credit their hotel stays and their car rentals to your program as well. So you really want them thinking about your program all the time, you know, buying their flowers for Valentine's Day. And you want them to do it through your shopping portal.
We talk about share of wallet and share of spend and share of mind. And this is, it's not just about being on the airplane.
And if you give them an excuse.
And quite frankly, it's growing, it's shifting, but if you're an airline program, you almost don't want it to be.
It could
be on the airplane.
The reality is it could be more profitable for your program and for your airline if they're earning their miles without flying.
Sure.
But the reality is what you want to do is you don't want to basically send the message to them, oh, you know what? It's not worth your while choosing us to fly us because we're not really going to give you any miles. So feel free to choose just whoever you want to fly today.
Yeah. Loyalty for some people is the only thing they consider, and I think that's a mistake. But for many people, it is something that's considered. And when that stops being a functional lever, when it stops being a useful switch, and you know the carrot isn't there.
If you're flying a simple route, you know, like Boston, New York, LA, San Francisco, you've got multiple carriers available to choose from. Essentially, they all price match, so they're all the same fare.
And often similar schedules.
You know, maybe it might even be every hour there's a flight, right. You know. You've got lots of choices. Why would you choose your normal program if they're essentially not giving you much for that at all? At some point, there's a tipping point where people give up and say, you know what, it doesn't really matter. I'm going to pick I'm going to pick a random airline, whichever one comes up on the Expedia search first.
Or,
and that's not the behavior.
Gosh, I need to go at the top of the hour, not the bottom of the hour. So I'm willing to switch airlines because that 30 minutes. What was I was getting 18 miles or 180 miles.
Yep.
For the 30 minute difference, I'd actually like to get home to dinner earlier instead.
That's exactly right. Or you know what? There's a nicer terminal in San Francisco. The security line is usually shorter, so yeah. I'll fly this airline instead of my primary airline.
Hell, I can save the 30. Am I willing to give up 500 points to save 30 minutes in a security line? Yeah. I think so.
So, and that's exactly right. And really, if your loyalty program, you want to give everybody the excuse to stay with you. You don't want to give them an excuse to leave. And this is a fine balance because you could also be too generous. And that was the argument with the old US programs, was maybe they were too generous, you know, and it was expensive for them and they weren't rewarding the right behavior. I think there's a halfway point between the two. And,
sure.
You know, you could argue exactly where that balance is. You know, but I think that that's the lesson that all the other airlines need to take on board, is you need to be careful that you don't go too far in the wrong direction.
Yeah. All right. So let's take our work hats off for a second now. That was a little more wonky than I expected the first 20 minutes to be, but we're both in Bangkok. We both started in the United States. We got here in spectacularly different fashion.
We did.
So you tell your story and I'll tell mine and we'll sort of intersperse back and forth.
Sure. Well, I was planning on just saving some money and coming on a cheap American Airlines economy fare. I think that was going to go to Hong Kong and then code share on Cathay from Hong Kong down to Bangkok. So I think that when I first looked, it was about $900 for the ticket. And I thought, that's not super, super cheap, but not expensive.
But it also doesn't involve flying on some of the airlines with connection points that you're not so keen on.
And that's exactly right. You know, airlines I'm happy to fly. I can accrue my miles on American Airlines, whatever, what have you. And, you know, to be honest, reasonably easy flight from Los Angeles. By the time I got around to booking the ticket, all of a sudden that had shot up to about, I think, $2,300.
Which is still amazing to me that that's a coach fare from LA to Bangkok.
And that's exactly.
And it wasn't like week of travel. You did this a couple weeks still ahead.
Absolutely. And, whatever reason, the price had jumped up, and all of a sudden jumped up significantly, you know, almost not quite three times the price, but getting, you know, certainly two and a half times the price. All of a sudden, it's like, well, if I'm going to be spending $2,300 on travel, maybe, you know what, maybe
I should have a little more personal space on that airplane.
Yeah, so I started looking for award seats. And I happened to find a business award seat on Japan Airlines via Osaka, and I was quite happy with that to start with. As it turned out, the timing wasn't perfect. I had a long layover in the evening. And a couple of days before travel, I just, for some reason, decided to search again. And lo and behold, a first class Japan Airlines Los Angeles to Tokyo came up with a business class connection to Bangkok. And it was a few extra miles, but I've got to say it was a case of, well, you know what? If I can't get a cheap economy ticket, why not splurge a little bit on that?
Once you're already in for a penny, in for a pound.
That's exactly what it was.
Once you've already started spending the miles, an extra couple hundred bucks for the upgrade.
That's essentially, that's exactly what I had to top up some extra miles to be able to do that upgrade. That was a very easy decision.
Yeah. So my experience was rather different than that. I flew. It's actually interesting. I booked my return trip from this event well before I booked my trip to get here.
Right.
And so there was the mistake with significant sale fare. I don't know, what are we calling it these days? Qatar Airways had a very good sale from flights from Hanoi to the United States or Vietnam. So I picked Hanoi just because I haven't been there yet and chose that as my outbound and got my tickets for my return trip on Sunday following the conference. So I had a ticket home. And then just figured, eventually something will come up to get me here. And eventually ANA had a sale for very cheap economy class tickets to Kuala Lumpur. And I bought one. And I actually had a choice of which awful connection I wanted. And there's basically a morning-ish flight and a mid-afternoon-ish flight leaving New York, like 11 a.m. and 4 p.m., I think, are the two times. And they arrive at 1:30 p.m. and 8 p.m. or something like that in Japan. One goes to the Narita, one goes to Haneda. And I booked, and then they connect onward to Southeast Asia. One arrives at midnight-ish, you know, but somewhere between 10:30 and 12:30 in the morning, and the other is a red-eye that leaves Japan at midnight and arrives down in Southeast Asia around 6 a.m. And I've done the midnight arrival in the past and didn't particularly like that. So I said, hey, let me try something a little different. An added bonus, it was a Haneda connection, which is a nicer airport to connect in than Narita, in my opinion. The New International Terminal is very nice. New line.
Yes.
But it was the... It's sort of the double red eye experience, and you know you don't want to try to stay on the flight that arrives at midnight. At least you sort of mentally want to stay awake for that second flight, so that when you know, in my mind, when I feet down, it's midnight, I'm going to sleep.
Yes,
I don't want to have just slept the last 6 hours, and I'm trying to adjust. This one, I wanted to be asleep, and again, you know, 6.5 hour economy flight. It was a 787, which is, I loved the experience, except that the seats are a little narrow. My seatmate elbowed me a few times. I had those problems. And then after all that, I was still only in Kuala Lumpur. So I had a separate ticket, little one-way hop from there.
And how long was your layover in Kuala Lumpur?
It's about 3 hours.
Okay.
And that was on purpose. I wanted to account for unprotected connection. I want to give myself a little bit of a buffer. I also figured that because I was flying, and this is a choice I made, I chose to pay a little extra to fly on Malaysia Airlines versus one of the low-cost carriers because they fly out of the main terminal, or the
yes.
same terminal that ANA arrives into. Their KLIA, the airport there, has two separate buildings, one for mainline and one for low-cost. And the low-cost terminal is actually like a wholly separate operation. It's not, you know, like Atlanta transferring from A to B or something like that. You actually clear immigration, get on a train, and at least it's a train now. It used to be a bus the first time I did it years ago. Ride over, and it's a paid train, actually. It costs you like $1.50 or something like that. Ride over to the other terminal, and then check in, and then re-clear immigration to leave. And I saw a sign this time that suggested maybe there was a bus that may have been inside security, but I'm not sure. And either way, I didn't want to have to deal with that schlep. And I was kind of hoping
not
I'd get a shower.
Not after the connections
Not after
already
the connections
done.
I was already doing. And I was kind of hoping to get a shower in the lounge in the morning. So I didn't get the shower. It was available, and I think I was just, at that point, too delirious to even actually process waiting in line and figuring it out. But it meant not having to leave the terminal and sort of being a little more, not sane, but a little more, you know, contained in my transfer. So, it's interesting, sort of the range of options and where those things go.
So, what was your total travel time with all those connections there?
With the connections, I think it was about 30 hours,
right.
30 to 36 hours. It was somewhere in that range. I left New York at, my flight took off at 4:45, so 5 o'clock, and I arrived in Bangkok at 10:30 local time in the morning 2 days later.
Right, yeah. And see,
it's
I think
a 12-hour difference. So,
despite me being obviously a nicer cabin class, but I think reducing my connection at Narita as well to 1.5 hours from originally I was in Osaka for six
sure.
and a half, I think it came down to about 20 hours.
Yeah,
which you know, so I mean, a big difference on the travel time. You know, not even accounting for the difference in the cabin class there. And I've got to say, I was still pretty, you know, pretty exhausted by the time I got here, and even the next morning when it was day for the conference. So,
well, right, and so that's one of these. Listen, I like business class. I like the bed. I like the experience. I started buying a lot of premium economy for myself when I can price it right, which out of Europe, which is where I usually am traveling to, all my tickets originate in Europe these days. And so I get the cheapest BA business class. I upgrade one way with Avios to go back on the red eye. It's not enough time to sleep anyways, but you know, JFK to London is just too short. I don't need a lot, but you're exhausted anyways. And part of that is you went to Asia. Like, your
yes.
body is off. Your circadian rhythms are off. How do you adjust that quickly? We're getting older, which, you know, sucks, but it's part of life. Beast the alternative, right? So does business class make it enough better to justify the cost? And where do you draw the line?
I think this is a challenge I have all the time, you know.
Me
and
too.
I think that in this particular case, I also justified it by the fact that I had a lot of work to do. So, for example, the trip from Los Angeles to Tokyo, yes, it was in first class in Japan Airlines, but I also was awake the entire flight, working the entire flight, other than the meal time. So, you know, I feel that I actually got some productivity on that flight. If I was in economy, you know, even an American, I wouldn't know if I would have just relaxed, watched a couple of movies, you know. Got
and that's just a matter of personal space, no room to pull out a laptop. And
that's exactly right. That said, you know, I mean, I travel regularly to Sydney from Los Angeles. And I mean, we joke about this all the time, but I consider it a bus trip. And when it's just me
it's
traveling,
a very long bus
you know,
ride.
Often I will literally, you know, I will choose economy rather than either spinning up or wasting the points on an award, a premium award. You know, quite often I can get a reasonable priced economy fare, and, you know, I can earn my points, I can earn my qualifying dollars.
And you're using those to spend on a more important trip somewhere down the line.
That's exactly right. And the reality is, you know, and especially, you know, when I'm going from Los Angeles to Sydney, it's a late evening departure. I'm ready to sleep by the time I get on the plane. It's a lot easier to get a few hours sleep. You arrive in a city in the morning. So the difference, the time change in that itinerary isn't actually so bad, at least not in one direction.
Yeah.
So, yeah, look, I think it's a challenge. I think it's not as simple as, you know, hey, it's all really easy to accrue all these miles and we should always redeem them for first class all the time. I think there's reasonings, you know, even as, you know, a savvy frequent flyer, to say, you know what, sometimes you can weigh it up and it's an opportunity cost. You can save your points and miles for a better value redemption later on, as you say, for a more important trip.
Interesting. Yeah, like I said, I like business class plenty, but I like traveling more.
And that's really what it is. If you can make your travel opportunities go further.
And I tell you what, my connection, I sort of woke up an hour and a half before landing in Tokyo at Haneda and realized that I was about to land and I was nowhere close to halfway through my trip. And it meant, physically I was fine, obviously. I'd slept most of the flight, more than I planned to, more than I kind of wanted to. I was fed, I was watered, everything was fine. Mentally, I was just, that sudden realization destroyed me. And I sat in the lounge just like
I think that
not quite miserable, but miserable.
I think the point is that it doesn't matter how comfortable you are on the plane. It doesn't matter how used to the travel you are. the reality is those big time zone changes, those, you know, those long trips with the multiple connections, you know, it is a mental challenge.
And some days are better than others.
Even when it's not a physical challenge. And that's exactly right.
Yeah. Parting shot.
Yes.
What do you got?
You know, I think it's interesting times in the industry, Seth. I think that, you know, we're very lucky and blessed, the fact that we have these opportunities to travel, you know, the day and age that we live in, the fact that, you know what, we can pick up, we can pick up international economy fares that are literally only a couple of $100 that allow us to see the world is an amazing and exciting time to be in.
I get bored one day. I can't, in fact, just go pay $600 and go to China because I want to see the Great Wall. That's kind of ridiculous.
It is, and...
And wonderful.
That's exactly right. And our people that don't, our friends and family that don't fly frequently, sometimes look at us sideways.
Yeah. As well they should. Thank you so much, David.
Thanks, Seth.
You can catch the podcast on Twitter at DotsLines, moredotsmorelines.com. Leave us some comments. Share some thoughts. Are we crazy and stupid or just, you know, one or the other?
Is there an all of the above option?
Definitely all of the above. All right. Take care.
Thanks, Seth.